Here on Radio 4 FM, our Book of the Week, Adrian Scarborough continues reading from Sapiens, A Short History of Humankind by Yuval Noah Harari. Today's instalment of this thought-provoking account, which charts our remarkable journey from insignificant apes to top of the pile, looks at whether we're any happier than our ancestors.
Until recently, peace meant the temporary absence of war. Even when two kingdoms were at peace, the outbreak of war between them was always a plausible scenario. An iron law of international relations posited that for every two nearby polities, there is a plausible scenario that they will be at war with one another within a year. If Germany and France were at peace in 1913, it was reasonable to assume that by 1914 they might be tearing each other to pieces. Today, this law of the jungle has been broken, and the concept of peace has acquired a new meaning. Peace is no longer just the absence of war, but rather the implausibility of war. When nowadays people say that Germany and France are at peace, they mean that the outbreak of a Franco-German war is unthinkable. This new kind of peace exists between most countries in the world. When the Brazilian government convenes to discuss the 2015 budget, it's unimaginable that the Brazilian defence minister will rise from his seat in the middle of the session, bang his fist on the table and shout, "Just a minute, and what if we want to invade and conquer Uruguay? You didn't take that into account. We have to put aside a few billion dollars so we'll be able to finance this conquest." Of course, there are a few places where defence ministers are still saying such things. And there are places where the new peace has failed to take root. But these are the exceptions. A central reason for the rise of the new peace is that while the invention of nuclear weapons dramatically increased the price of war, changes in the global economy simultaneously reduced the profits of war. For much of history, most wealth consisted of material goods such as wheat fields and gold mines, so it was easy to loot or occupy it. Today, wealth consists mainly of human capital and organisational know-how. Consequently, it is difficult to conquer it by military force. Consider what would happen if China were to invade California. Let's assume that the Chinese had managed to conquer Silicon Valley. What would they have gained? There are no silicon mines in Silicon Valley. The valley's wealth resides in the minds of Google and Facebook engineers who would be on the first plane to Bangalore long before the Chinese Navy sailed into San Francisco Bay. It is not coincidental that the few full-scale international wars that still take place, such as the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, occur in places where wealth is old-fashioned material wealth. The Kuwaiti sheikhs could flee abroad, but the oil fields stayed put and were occupied. The decline of war is not the only human achievement of recent decades. Equally impressive is the drop in child mortality, the rise in life expectancy, the disappearance of mass famines, and the spread of democracy. But are we happier? We are obviously far more powerful and prosperous than our medieval or Stone Age ancestors, but are we also more satisfied with our lives? If not, what was the point of developing agriculture, cities, writing, coinage, science and industry? There are two main reasons why scientists suspect that despite all our amazing achievements, we are not much happier than our ancestors. First, on a psychological level, when conditions improve, expectations rise, and consequently even dramatic improvements in conditions can leave people as dissatisfied as before. Just ask Hosni Mubarak. The average Egyptian was far less likely to die from starvation, plague, or violence under Mubarak than under any previous regime in Egyptian history. Nevertheless, in 2011, Egyptians did not go dancing wildly in the streets thanking Allah for their good fortune. Rather, they took to the streets in anger to overthrow Mubarak, for they had much higher expectations than their ancestors. There is also a biological reason why growing power does not translate easily into greater happiness. Our mental and emotional world is governed by biochemical mechanisms that were shaped by millions of years of evolution. Our happiness is not determined by our wealth or political rights. Rather, it is determined by a complex system of neurons, synapses, and biochemicals. According to biologists, nobody is ever made happy by winning the lottery, buying a house, or even finding true love. People are made happy by one thing and one thing only: pleasant sensations in their bodies. Unfortunately, for all hopes of creating heaven on earth, our internal biochemical system is programmed to keep happiness levels relatively constant. Pleasant sensations are only momentary rewards that soon subside, for evolution has no interest in keeping us pleased. It is interested only in survival and reproduction. Since our biochemical system has not changed significantly in recent millennia, there's no reason to think that we are much happier than our ancestors. Compare a modern London banker to his forefather, a medieval peasant. The peasant lived in an unheated mud hut overlooking the local pigsty, while the banker goes home to a splendid penthouse with all the latest technological gadgets. Intuitively, we would expect the banker to be much happier than the peasant. However, when the medieval peasant completed the construction of his mud hut, his brain secreted serotonin, bringing it up to level X. When in 2014 the banker made the last payment on his wonderful penthouse, his brain secreted a similar amount of serotonin, bringing it up to a similar level X. It makes no difference to the brain that the penthouse is far more comfortable than the mud hut. The only thing that matters is that at present, the level of serotonin is X. Consequently, the banker would not be one iota happier than the peasant. If happiness is really determined by our biochemical system, then further economic growth, social reforms, and political revolutions are unlikely to make us much happier. Some argue that happiness shouldn't be identified with pleasure, and that the real key to happiness is feeling that your life has meaning. The problem with that approach is that from a purely scientific viewpoint, human life has absolutely no meaning. Humans are the outcome of blind evolutionary processes that operate without goal or purpose. Our actions are not part of some great cosmic plan. And if planet Earth were to explode tomorrow morning, the universe would keep going about its business as usual. Hence, any meaning that people ascribe to their lives is just a delusion. So if happiness is based on feeling pleasant sensations, then in order to be happier, we need to re-engineer our biochemical system. If happiness is based on feeling that life is meaningful, then we need to delude ourselves more effectively. Is there a third alternative? One interesting alternative has been suggested by Buddhism. According to Buddhism, all feelings, whether of pleasure or of meaning or of anything else, are just ephemeral vibrations that disappear as fast as they arise. If 5 minutes ago I felt joyful and purposeful, that feeling is now gone and I may well feel angry or bored. If I identify happiness with particular feelings and crave to experience more and more of these, I have no choice but to constantly pursue them, and even if I get them, they immediately disappear and I have to start all over again. This pursuit brings no lasting achievement. It creates only stress and dissatisfaction. However, if I learn to see my feelings for what they really are, ephemeral and meaningless vibrations, I lose interest in pursuing them and can be content with whatever I experience. For what is the point of running after something that disappears as fast as it arises? For Buddhism, then, happiness isn't a particular feeling, but rather the wisdom, serenity, and freedom that come from understanding our true nature. If this is so, then our entire understanding of the history of happiness might be misguided. Maybe it isn't so important whether people's expectations are fulfilled and whether they enjoy pleasant sensations. The main question is whether people know the truth about themselves. What evidence do we have that people today understand this truth any better than ancient foragers or medieval peasants? In 1818, Mary Shelley published Frankenstein, the story of a scientist who tries to create a superior being and instead creates a monster. At first sight, the Frankenstein story appears to warn us that if we try to play God and engineer life, we will be punished severely. Yet the story has a deeper meaning. The Frankenstein myth confronts Homo sapiens with the fact that our last days are fast approaching. Unless some nuclear or ecological catastrophe intervenes, the pace of technological development will soon lead to the replacement of Homo sapiens by completely different beings who possess not only superior physiques, but also very different cognitive and emotional worlds. This is something most sapiens find extremely disconcerting. We seek comfort in the fantasy that Dr. Frankenstein can create only terrible monsters, whom we would have to destroy. We like to tell the story that way because it implies that we are the best of all beings, that there never was and never will be something better than Homo sapiens. We would have a hard time swallowing the fact that future scientists could create something that will look at us as condescendingly as we look at the Neanderthals. We cannot stop these Frankensteins because their projects are inextricably meshed together with our quest for immortality. Ask scientists why they study the genome or try to connect a brain to a computer, and they will rarely tell you that they're trying to create some superior godlike being. 9 out of 10 times, you'll be told that we're doing it to cure diseases and save human lives. What the scientists don't say is that the same knowledge that can protect and extend our lives can also be utilized to upgrade humans into something completely different. How long, then, do we have left? Probably not more than a few centuries, perhaps only a few decades. But though we cannot stop this process, we can try to influence its direction. As members of one of the final generations of sapiens, the most important question facing us is, what do we want to become? However, since we might soon be able to engineer our desires too, the real question is, what do we want to want? Those who are not spooked by this question probably haven't given it enough thought.
Adrian Scarborough was reading Sapiens, A Short History of Humankind by Yuval Noah Harari. The book was abridged by Penny Lester and produced by Gemma Jenkins. And there's more exclusive content, including an interview with the author, on the Radio 4 website. Jenny Murray talks to leading women in children's television after the news.
Comedy at 6:30 on BBC Radio 4.
My name is long and ridiculous, like my face. They call me Benedict Cumberbatch.
A brand new impression and sketch show.
I'm an acquired taste, like Lapsang Souchong. Distinctive, expensive, deep, rich, and surprisingly popular in China.
Lewis McLeod is not himself.
I have to exit dramatically through a window or something for no reason other than it looks fantastic.
On Tuesday evening at 6:30,